Thank you all so much for coming back for the continuation of our series. Last week we began by learning that social psychologists are reporting that many people today are struggling with what they regard as a disillusioning present, battling melancholy that arises from the loss of an ideal, the crushing of a hope, and the danger we discovered of such melancholy is that sorrow, grieving over something that we feel is lost, becomes a substitute for action, for investment of the self in the present, for action that could lead to transformation. I've been thinking about that, I'm sure you have, as we approach Martin Luther King Day, right? Tomorrow. Did you see the latest Gallup poll over the weekend that 80%, 8 out of 10 of our fellow citizens who are African American feel that the country has gone backwards in terms of relations between the races? Now, the premise of our course, and the reason not to give up, is that as we discovered, began to learn last week, Jesus himself was struggling with powerful emotions. During the last weeks of his life, according to Luke, when he came within sight of the city of Jerusalem, he what? Wept. Wept over the city. When he went into the temple and began turning over the tables and driving out the money changers, the Gospels say that he was burning with zeal. Kind of emotional ignition had taken place within him. And then, of course, he was agonizing in the Garden of Gethsemane. All of the Gospels witness to this, that Jesus was struggling during the last weeks of his life with powerful emotions. And so our course is going to follow Jesus on his tumultuous emotional journey. And I think what we're going to find is that he broke free of captivity to loss and grief. And by doing that, if we can learn how, from the Gospels, from a close reading of the text, then his way to freedom, his therapy, might become the path for us. He might be, as he always has been, the agent of salvation for us in our difficult moment. Now, at the end of class last week, my colleague, my old Vanderbilt classmate, Gary Luttrell, asked a very good and pointed question. And he challenged me to try to identify more honestly the loss that we feel. And Gary, I thought about that, you know, as the week went by, and running around in my memory was a quotation. And some of you here may be as old as I am, and so you'll be able to identify the author of this quotation. This is the final two sentences of an inaugural address. Finally, whether you are citizens of America or citizens of the world, ask of us here the same high standards of strength and sacrifice which we ask of you. With a good conscience as our only sure reward, and with history as the final judge of our deeds, let us go forth to lead the land that we love, asking, listen to this, His blessing and His help. And it's the last part that I love the best. But knowing that here on earth, God's work must be our own. Now, even without attempting to reflect a Massachusetts accent, you know who that was, right? In our own lifetime, a political leader could inaugurate his attempt to lead the land that he loved by invoking God's work here on earth. Knowing that God's work must be our own. Well, we discovered last week that there's a turning point in the ministry, in the work of Jesus. The first part of the Gospels, he's up in Galilee, in the sunshine, propounding unforgettable, beautiful parables that call people alongside of the mystery of God's reign. And he is treating people, healing their diseases, casting out demons, pushing back against the intolerable constraints upon the full humanity that God intended in creation. And then comes the news that John the Baptist had been what?
Beheaded.
And that news sinks in. And Jesus begins to realize that the kingdom of God is not going to drop from the sky. It's not going to come as quickly or easily as he might have thought. He begins to understand that for him and for anyone who follows him, it's going to involve what? Suffering, struggle, even death. It's a paradoxical insight. And in order to follow the repercussions of that turning in Jesus' life and how he decided to keep on struggling for the kingdom of God, we're going to turn this morning to the Gospel of Luke. Now, you may be wondering, well, Larry, I thought the first gospel was what? Mark. So why are we leaving Mark and going to what might be, probably is, the latest of the four gospels? For a simple reason. The account of Jesus' journey from Galilee to Jerusalem, his decision to leave Galilee and march on Jerusalem, occupies one paragraph of Mark's gospel. There's not much there. Even if he had traveled directly without stopping along the way to heal people or to teach, the foot journey from Galilee to Jerusalem would have occupied 3 days. So you would think there would be more than one paragraph in the Gospel of Mark. And this is where Luke helps us. In the Gospel of Luke, the journey from Galilee to Jerusalem begins in chapter 9, verse 51, where we will start this morning, and goes all the way down to chapter 19. So it's 10 chapters. When you read the Gospel of Luke, you get a real picture of what was happening on that journey, what was going on in Jesus' mind and heart. Now, how can we put so much confidence in it after all, if Luke is not the earliest gospel? Well, students of the gospels know a secret about the gospel of Luke. Luke incorporates the most primitive source, a collection of Jesus's what? Sayings that New Testament scholars call Q, from the German word quella. And it is that precious early memory of what Jesus preached that Luke inserts into his gospel just at this point on the journey to Jerusalem. Luke is a profound, he's not just a historian, he is that. He's a very conservative editor of Q, more conservative than Matthew. But Luke is also a theologian. He's thinking deeply about Jesus and his way to the cross, to Jerusalem. And so we're going to keep both of those things in mind. The primitive source, what Jesus actually said, and in some cases, Gary, what I found interesting in preparing for today is that some of the sayings of Jesus to which we're going to now devote our attention are not only found in Q, they are also independently attested in Thomas, the Gospel of Thomas, which has no relationship to Q. So that I could make an argument, others have, Helmut Kester, Francois Bovon, that some of the material that we are looking at today goes right back to Jesus. That it's not only the theological artistry of Luke, but it gives us contact with Jesus himself. Okay, here we go.
Sir,
yes, please.
Was Luke a contemporary of Jesus or not? Because this was written later, you said.
You're absolutely right. No, he was not.
He was not.
We don't know who Luke was. The earliest copies of Luke don't have the name Luke attached to it. Probably the latest scholarship is that the author of the two-volume masterpiece, Luke plus Acts. The author probably lived and was working in the early 2nd century. About 120 is a good date, I think, for the Gospel of Luke.
Was he a physician, like we think?
Well, you see, the traveling companion of Paul, named Luke, was a physician. But whether that person is the same as what? The author. But what I can tell you just based upon close reading of the text, and Gary, you could probably bear me out in this, whoever wrote the two-volume masterpiece is the best writer in the New Testament. His Greek is the highest, and his theological insight is so great. So I'm grateful for the opportunity to journey through part of Luke with you all. Yes.
Who wrote down the quotes in Q, and when were they written down?
Thank you. So a lot of work has gone into this. Ever since the 1830s, when Christian Hermann Weyse noticed that Matthew and Luke agree word for word in many of their accounts of the sayings of Jesus. I had a good friend, an optometrist, who was a member of Westminster downtown. And when I pointed this out to him one Sunday in a class like this, and I asked the class, how could that happen? How could Matthew and Luke just happen to agree on the word-for-word text of Jesus' sayings? Dr. Erbau raised not his hand, but his cane into the air and said with a tone of genuine, heartfelt indignation, somebody copied. Bless your heart, Dr. Erbau, that's right. Someone copied. There's lots of scholarship on Q. One of my best friends in the academic world, John Kloppenborg, at the University of Toronto is the living authority on this primitive source. He dates it to the 50s of the first century. It's clearly composed in Galilee, because the locations, the places where the Q material comes back to again and again, are a little group of villages in the southern tier of the Galilee, Bethsaida, Cana of Galilee. One more thing about Q. Whoever put it together, what I find most interesting and inspiring is that these people endeavored to continue Jesus' own way of life. Itinerant. Right? Moving around from place to place. Preaching the kingdom of God. Caring for the sick. So I find that very interesting. There's no liturgical material in Q. No Lord's Supper, no baptism. What are we looking at? It's not what? An established church. It's a movement. So for about a generation, a group of people in the Galilee continue Jesus' own way of life. And it's those people, members of that movement, that we have to thank for the earliest source that we have about Jesus. Now, in the Gospel of Luke, Jesus, like the same in the Gospel of Mark, he knows that suffering awaits him if he continues his work for the kingdom of God. Luke chapter 9, verse 22, Jesus tells the disciples, the Son of Man, the way he refers to himself, must undergo great suffering and be rejected by the elders, the chief priest and the scribes, and be killed. Luke chapter 9, verses 43 to 45, listen to this. While everyone was amazed at all that he was doing, he was saying to his disciples, "Let these words sink in to your ears. The Son of Man is going to be betrayed into human hands." And then Luke adds, "But they did not understand this saying, and they were afraid to ask him about this saying." We're going to come back to that. This is so human, right? So relatable. The difficulty that we all have comprehending that our highest ideals, our truest hopes, require suffering, struggle, that they may not be attainable in the way we thought. And finally, just to set up the text we're going to look at, Luke chapter 9, verses 46 to 47, the disciples are arguing, even after Jesus has told them what awaits him, they are arguing about what? Who is going to be greatest in the kingdom of God? And Jesus places a little child beside him, and he says, "Whoever welcomes this child, the least among you," see the paradox? "The least among you is the greatest." All right, now we come to our text. Luke chapter 9, verse 51. Here's my translation. "And it happened that the days for him to be taken up were approaching, and he set his face to go to Jerusalem." Here's the first lesson for us for today. The verb that is translated, "he set his face," is the Greek verb stairizo. Can you say that with me?
Stairizo.
Listen to what it means. It means to fix firmly in place. So he fixes his face firmly toward the destiny that he knows is coming. But guess what else it means? Listen to this. It means to cause to be inwardly committed. To cause to be inwardly firm or committed. And finally, it means to be determined to accomplish an objective. Luke has chosen this verb so carefully to convey the courage, the resolve, right? The determination to work through the disappointment, the melancholy.
Use all three meanings.
All three meanings, yeah. Luke is so much in command of the Greek language, he chooses words that are so rich and in some ways deliberately ambiguous. And I just want to point out that in the passage to which we're devoting our attention now, Luke chapter 9, verses 51 to 56, there are no less than three times when Luke says he set his face. His face was fixed. He repeats it three times, just in case we missed it. The other thing I want to point out is the fact that in this passage, there is lots of journey vocabulary. The Greek verb poruestai, which means what?
To travel.
Exactly. To take a journey, to travel, to move from one place to another. And then a perfect illustration of Luke's artistry, his grasp of the fullness of language, is a word that Gary and I have already talked about online before class today. Analepsis. Now, in my translation, I translated it, and it happened that the days were complete or fulfilled to be taken up, that was approaching. Now, this word analepsis is rich and ambiguous. It could refer to his journey. When you go to Jerusalem, you're going where? Up into the hills. But of course, if you're a Christian author, or if you're a Christian reader, to be taken up could refer to what? His ascension. His return to God the Father, which is accomplished only by his death and resurrection. It's an interesting word that Luke uses. Chapter 9, verse 52. And he sent messengers, here it comes again, before his face. So, his inner firmness, his determination to reach the goal, he sends messengers forward with the same purpose. And then Luke says, having set out on their way, another example of this verb for to travel, to journey, they entered a village of the Samaritans to make ready for him. Now this verb that's translated to make ready, heptoimasai, can you say that with me? It is the same verb that is used back in Luke chapter 3, verse 6, to describe what John the Baptist does for the one who comes after him, the greater one. John does what? He makes ready. Now, this is, I think, so profound on Luke's part. Luke knows, and Jesus knows, what happened to John the Baptist. He was brutally beheaded. His head was brought into a banquet that Herod gave on what? A platter. And knowing all that, Luke uses the same verb to describe the mission upon which Jesus now sends his disciples. In other words, the disciples are new John the Baptists. They are continuing the mission and activity of John the Baptist, even though they know what happened to him. You follow this? Chapter 9, verse 53. Now, this describes the reaction of the Samaritans into whose village or city the disciples have come. But they did not receive him because his face was going or was set toward Jerusalem. Now, the background here is hostility between Jews and Samaritans. During the reign of Claudius, a group of Galilean pilgrims, Josephus tells us all about this in book 20 of his Antiquities of the Jews. Josephus says that a group of Galilean pilgrims set off for the feast, the Passover, in Jerusalem, and the shortest route from Galilee to Jerusalem passes through what?
Samaria.
And guess what happened to them? Because of the hostility, they were massacred by the Samaritans in a little town called Ginea. And of course, then what happened? The Jews retaliated, right? The same sort of violence that we see over there
right now.
Yes. But Luke is doing something more here than just reflecting the background. Luke is suggesting that the disciples were not welcome by the Samaritans because he had what? Set his face toward Jerusalem. I don't know how Luke thinks that he can get into the hearts and the minds of the Samaritans and how he can attribute to them rejection of Jesus because they know what his purpose is. But that's what Luke does. And we'll come back to the lesson for us in a few minutes.
Larry,
yes?
I mean, you don't know the answer to that.
I don't.
Well, I was going to ask you about
good.
That.
Ask.
Well, you don't know the answer.
Well, neither does the great Harvard commentator on the Gospel of Luke, Francois Bavon. Do you know what he says about this? He says, Luke rather awkwardly attributes to the Samaritans a knowledge of what Jesus had determined to do.
If they were Jewish people going through Samaria that direction,
yes,
they would say to themselves, well, they're obviously going up toward Jerusalem.
Yes.
And Jerusalem is not the right place to worship God.
Because, that's right.
Because they got it all wrong. It's supposed to be here in
Mount Gerizim, yeah.
So,
There is no doubt that Luke is evoking the background well-known of fighting and hostility between Jews and Samaritans. But he does go beyond that. He suggests that the Samaritans rejected the purpose of Jesus, his inner resolve. And how Luke thinks he knows that, I don't know. I guess he's trying to make a point.
Why weren't they massacred?
These Samaritans, thank you. Watch what happens next in the story. Listen to this. Chapter 9, verse 54. And his disciples, namely James and John, saw it. They saw the Samaritan rejection of Jesus, and they said, Lord, do you want us to call fire to come down from heaven and consume them? Now, just at that point, Gary, several manuscripts add the words, as Elijah did. So they're drawing upon the precedent of one of God's prophets. Jesus, do you want, since they've rejected you, do you want us to engage in punishment, vindictive punishment? The temptation here is one that is so close to us in our situation. Our loss of ideals, the disappointment of our hopes, there is a great temptation that it will, that we will respond to that by destructive energy, lashing out at those that we think are responsible for our disappointments. The invocation of Elijah here suggests that James and John understood their destructive energy as a kind of religious zeal, religious zealotry. And that too, I think, is a danger, a temptation for us. When Diane and I visited Drew University last March, and I was confronted with the melancholy of the cool kids, some of the best and brightest young students of theology. The keynote speaker on that occasion was a philosopher from Columbia University. You remember, Diane, named Gil Anijar. He and I got into a little debate, and that continued through email. But guess what his paper advocated? His paper praised the destructive character. You remember that? He told those young people in their grief, in their Afro-pessimism, in their utopian melancholy, he said, what we need now are destructive characters. Oh, that's not what we need, according to Luke and according to Jesus. But it's a temptation, isn't it? Right? The temptation is to lash out, to punish those that we think are responsible for what? The disappointment of our hopes. Now look at the next verse. Something really interesting is going on here. Chapter 9, verse 55. But he, that is Jesus, turned and rebuked them. Now, Gary, watch this. Just at this point, a number of manuscripts. Can I show you something? My poor Bible is falling apart. Here's the Greek text, right? Mm-hmm. But what's down here?
Footnotes.
Footnotes. In those footnotes, the editors reveal variant readings. You see, our New Testament is based upon 2,000 manuscripts, approximately, that survive. And no two manuscripts are the same. So, just at this point, chapter 9, verse 55, a significant number of manuscripts, Cantabrigiensis or Codex Bezae, Washingtonus, the Freer Gospel, that you can see if you go to Washington. They'll let you look at it if you go to the museum. The St. Gall manuscript, the Vulgate translation, several Syriac translations, and most importantly, Tatian's Diatessaron. Does anyone know who this guy was, Tatian? He lived in the 2nd century. He was a Syrian. He went to Rome to get an education. He studied with a Christian philosopher named Justin Martyr. And in about the year 170, Tatian had an idea. He said, I'm going to compose a harmony of the four Gospels. Put the four Gospels together into one book. He called it the Diatessaron, 1 through 4. So, actually, Tatian's Diatessaron is older than the surviving manuscripts of the Gospel of Luke. Okay, listen to this. Just at this point, all of those manuscripts that I mentioned, plus Tatian's Diatessaron, insert the following verse. See, it's just after the text says, but he, that is Jesus, turned and rebuked them, and then it continues, and he said, you do not know what kind of spirit you are. The Son of Man has not come to destroy the lives or the souls of human beings, but to save them. You see what's going on here? When the disappointment of our hopes, the loss of our ideals, the rejection of our message, when that hits us, we're tempted to do what? Lash out. Respond with religious zealotry or vindictive violence against those that we think are responsible. Jesus blocks it. He says, no, you don't know what sort of spirit you ought to have. The Son of Man has not come to destroy the souls or the lives of human beings, but to save them. I think that's a wonderful insight. Yes, please. Joan.
So it was in all these early manuscripts. Why isn't it in the Bible?
Yes, thank you. Thank you. It's because the committee that put together the text that is translated for us into English, they work on the basis of a principle. And the principle is that the oldest surviving manuscripts ought to be preferred. And the oldest manuscripts don't have that verse. But I think that the testimony of Tatian and all these early translations, the Vulgate, the Syriac, suggest that the verse was probably there. It's a decision, right, that interpreters have to make. Yes, Larry.
Depends a little bit on one's point of view as to whether something is destroyed or not. So
right.
As Jesus goes and enters the temple and challenges the law that is financial law that is involved,
right.
Those people would view that as destruction.
They would.
So one has to ask, what is the motivation? So for the disciples, it would be destroy them. Well, that's revenge,
right.
Which is different than changing the system. But again, it depends on the point of view. And so you can imagine that some people in Jerusalem said he came to destroy, not to save.
Right, right. And we could apply that to our situation today, right? I mean, we've been talking about utopian melancholy, right? But there's a lots of other people in the United States who are upset and angry because they feel like that the values of their own culture are slipping away with all of this multiculturalism and relativism, challenges to the Second Amendment and gun rights. And for them too, I think the temptation, just as it is for us, the temptation is to blame someone, to lash out, and to feel right in doing so. James and John say, shall we call down fire upon them as who did? Elijah did. So they feel like vindictiveness, punishment, is religiously justified. And that's why I think this variant in the text is so important. In the variant, Jesus clarifies that the way beyond a sense of being aggrieved, the way beyond destructive vindictiveness, is not to destroy. It's to heal and to save. It's the way of reconciliation. Yes?
What's the difference between revenge and reform?
It's a good question. Larry, you were kind of pointing in this direction too. What's the difference between revenge, retaliation, and reform? That's what we need to think about. Jesus clearly intends to bring about some reform within Judaism. When he gets to the temple and is burning with zeal, it's a zeal for God's house that consumes him. And evidently he feels like the exploitation of the temple needs to be reformed and changed. So this is an important question that you're asking. Chapter 9, verse 56. Then they went on. There's that verb again. They continued the journey to a different village. In other words, Jesus' reproof, Jesus' attempt to short-circuit vindictive zealotry, it makes it possible for the disciples to continue the journey with Jesus. Now, Luke doesn't say whether they were welcomed in the different village to which they went. Did that village open up to God's message? The message of the kingdom? Luke's silence at this point, I think, is deliberate. I think he leaves the question open, because he wants to focus the reader's attention on the journey, on the fact that they don't stop. They keep going with Jesus toward Jerusalem. Now, I'd like to look back over this passage that we've just been unpacking, and I'd like to try to draw out some lessons for our situation. First of all, what we see here is a powerful conflict of emotions, like the ones that we're feeling, whichever side of the political debate we're on. Three emotions are put into the foreground by Luke. First, there is Jesus's what? Stay-reed-so. His firm resolve to persevere. His determination. Then there is the Samaritan's emotion of rejection. They're evidently closed off to the message that Jesus brings. And finally, the disciples, with whom I think the reader is encouraged by Luke to identify. The disciples are what? Angry, frustrated, vindictive. In other words, the disciples illustrate the human, all too human tendency to fail to comprehend the way of reconciliation, healing, sacrifice, and peace. The failure to comprehend that God has a plan underneath the apparent loss and disappointment. That's what Jesus is holding on to. His conviction that God has a plan underneath the apparent rejection. A failure to understand what it will take to carry out God's paradoxical plan. The second lesson of this text is that vengeance is not the way. However we draw that line between vindictiveness and reform, vengeance is not Jesus' way. What Jesus illustrates is perseverance, continuing to spread the message, healing, the healing of souls rather than their destruction. In other words, Jesus renounces the vindictive option. That's the message of this text. What will succeed is love. Even if that love is initially rejected. In other words, let's draw the conclusion. At this moment, those of us who find the firmness, stay read so, to persevere beyond disappointment, we must be prepared to be what? Rejected. That's the message of this text. The disciples are rejected, and Jesus is rejected. We must be prepared to be rejected. And we must not succumb at that moment to what? Vengeance. All right. Yes, please.
Yeah, I don't think it's just vengeance. I think you just become apathetic. Like, you know, no one's listening.
I agree with you.
Vengeance is one choice, and there's destruction and there's disruption, just like we disrupt industries. But I think, you know, I think we're politically correct. Just keep your mouth shut and live your life. You do what, I mean, you have to read so. But we live in a society that's safe not to talk.
You're quite right. And even though Luke focuses on anger, frustration, vindictiveness, we might say to Luke, look, lots of us are just disappointed. And in our disappointment, we're not ready to go on to another village and try this again. Hold on to that thought, because that's going to be addressed in the very next paragraph of Luke's text. You're a whole paragraph ahead of us. Yes.
In response, or just observation, the comment, I think it was Michelle who made it. I think it makes a difference if you're a leader or if you're a follower. Jesus was a leader. Gandhi was a leader. Martin Luther King was a leader. Mm. They never gave up. They persisted in their goal. There were those who thought, well, I'll follow, but then things didn't go right, become apathetic, and they withdraw, and they crawl into their own hole.
Did you hear that? That's so important. And if in this paragraph, Luke's focus is upon the leader, the one who inwardly has committed himself,
yes,
and who sends out messengers to forward that commitment, in the very next paragraph, the focus is upon the followers. Now what? Look at the next paragraph. Chapter 9, verses 57 to 62. And as they were going along the road, there's that travel, that journey again. Someone said to him, notice the person is anonymous. This is not a named candidate for discipleship. And I think, again, Luke is deliberate in leaving the person anonymous. It encourages us to what? Identify with it. See ourselves in it. And as they were going along the road, someone said to him, I will follow you wherever you go. Uh-oh. So it appears that there is a person who is ready to make an unconditional, lasting commitment to Jesus' journey. His journey beyond disappointment. His journey into action to transform things. Even if it leads to suffering. I will follow you where? Even to Jerusalem. Wherever you go. Now look at how Jesus replies. Jesus' reply makes clear that this candidate for discipleship does not yet understand the repercussions of becoming a follower, of being a follower. Chapter 9, verse 58, quote, and Jesus said to him, foxes have what? Holes. And the birds of the air have what?
Nests.
but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. The way to overcome utopian melancholy is to remain on the move, not to hunker down and find security in our disappointment. Even if this means that our lives have lost their certainty, that we are less settled than we were before, that we are even less secure than the most agile and mobile animals. This past summer in our community garden, Diane had an epiphany of a red fox. He stepped out of the woods for 2 or 3 seconds and then was gone. From neighbors, we learned that the fox had a kit of 6 or 7 little foxes back up in the woods. But after a couple of weeks, he vanished, never appeared again. As a sign of my advancing age, I'm becoming a bird watcher, very avid. And I can tell you that foxes have holes and birds may have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. The lesson for us is this. Oh, it's a hard lesson. We have to resist the quite natural tendency to look for a safe place, to look for a sanctuary, to make a nest for ourselves. Leaving home and moving on as an adult in a disappointing and inhospitable world. That is the way of Jesus. In other words, what we have to deal with, I would put it this way, we have to deal, if we're going to get out of the disappointment and the melancholy, we have to embrace somehow the shock of destabilization. The shock of destabilization. Because the only security, it is in God. A couple of more verses. Chapter 9, verses 59 to 60. Then to another prospective disciple, Jesus said, "Follow me." And the disciple said, "First, let me go and do what? Bury my father." But Jesus said to him, "You know it. Let the dead bury the dead." It's a word play, right? A profound word play. Let the spiritually dead bury what? The physically dead. But as for you, go and spread, diffuse the news about the kingdom of God. Now, the key word here is that word go. It's the verb, Gary, up, erchomai, which literally means what?
Go from or come from.
Yes, thank you. See, it's so good that Gary can reassure you while I'm not making this stuff up.
Yeah, but you guys don't know I'm making it.
In other words, the key concept here is departure. To go from, to go away from. Up erchomai. Following Jesus to freedom from disappointment, melancholy, vindictiveness. Following Jesus to freedom from those things means departing. It means leaving the reassuring context, even of our childhood, the reassuring context of whatever parent we've carried with us in our hearts. Now, Jesus' reply is shocking, isn't it? Scandalous. I mean, children are expected to accompany their parents to their final resting place. But I'd like to take this more broadly. Jesus' aphorism is deliberately hyperbolic. It's meant to be shocking. More generally, what I think Jesus is demanding is a break with the religion of duty, with submission to tradition as a place of safety for ourselves in a time of disappointment. In other words, let me put it this way, nostalgic attachment is tantamount to keeping company with the dead. You follow that? Nostalgic attachment to what we have lost is a way of dying. Or, I'll put it another way, Jesus' aphorism reveals that elective mortality, the decision just to let ourselves, to give in to inertia. Is that the way you put it? I thought it was very profound what you said. Jesus' aphorism reveals that elective mortality can become a companion of inescapable mortality. What am I trying to say? Well, we all know where the journey ends for each one of us. Young people may think that they are what? Immortal. But those of us who have suffered a detached retina know that that's not the way the story ends. Mortality is inescapable, but it doesn't have to be chosen. We don't have to spend our time in the cemetery. Now, that's what Jesus calls us away from. He says, do what? Apergomai. Depart from that nostalgic attachment to what you think that you have lost, even if it is something that you think you were given by your own parents. If we want to be free, the imperative is to depart from past attachments and to proclaim God's reign. And the verb that is used here, Gary, for proclaiming God's reign, it's really interesting. It's diangelo. You see that prefix? Diangelo? Luke has added, or Jesus has added, a prefix to the verb for to announce or to herald. Angelo, to proclaim, it means to diffuse. Diangelo means to diffuse, to spread it everywhere, to proclaim the good news in every direction. That's what it means to be called away from nostalgic attachments, away from the cemetery. Two more verses. Chapter 9, verses 61 and 62. And still another potential disciple, still another said, I will follow you, Lord, but let me first say farewell to those at my home. But Jesus said to him, what? No one who has put his hand to the plow looks back. No such person is fit or usable for the kingdom of God. So the ancestors, the parents, are not the only ones who may keep us from freedom. They're not the only ones that may keep us from following Jesus on this journey. There's also the world of our family members, those at our homes. Jesus' response, his response about no one who has put his hand to the plow and then does what? Looks back. Jesus' response warns against the desire to turn back, to look back. Or, I'll put it this way, regrets are not helpful. Right? Don't have regrets. Don't look back. Concentrate on the goal. Only such a disciple, Jesus says, is outhetos, useful for the kingdom of God. Now, looking back over this second passage, chapter 9, verses 57 to 22, to 62, here are the lessons, I think, for us to think about. First, the journey beyond disappointment, beyond anger and frustration, beyond vindictiveness, it necessitates, it requires a departure. And then after we have departed from those things, we have to go along the road. We have to keep moving. The three candidates for this discipleship in this passage, notice that each one of them, this is so interesting, each one of them are stuck at the stage of wishing. Oh, Lord, I would follow you anywhere, right? I want to go with you, but let me what? Bury the dead. I would like to go with you. I will, but I want to go back and say what?
Farewell
to the people at home. None of these people actually succeed in following Jesus because they get stuck at the stage of just wishing and wanting. In other words, they are still torn by nostalgic attachments to what they've lost.
And I just go to choir, so we're... So that's why I'm leaving.
Well, here's my... As you're going, here's my last question for next week. If we have to do all this in order to follow Jesus on his emotional journey, if we have to give up all these nostalgic attachments and move beyond security, what is the advantage of giving all of that up? The answer comes next week. In the next two or three passages of Luke's Gospel, if you want to read ahead. Yes, please.
Yeah, you caught me early on with the Cerezo. I think I was thinking of a general who is leading a group against a superior force. Mm. He has to set his face.
Right.
And he has to stick with it.
Right.
And if he has guys that are going to have to get distracted, well, what am I going to do about sleeping tonight, or what am I going to do for food? He can't use these people. He needs them. Kind of like football. Marathon when the 300 were up again.
Right.
I mean, if he had any people that weren't going to stick with him,
right,
they weren't of use to him.
Right.
And the reward, of course, was if you win, you got something.
Right. That's exactly right. That's a good insight into what it takes to carry out the resolve, right?
Yeah.
To follow. Other comments, questions?
Take your leader carefully.
Yes.
Earthly versus heavenly.
I'm sorry?
Earthly versus heavenly. That's what this all seems to be about. Setting your eyes on what's here on earth when you say goodbye to those who are on earth versus going to serve Jesus and the glory of heaven.
Right. Right. And even if heaven doesn't operate for some people as a concept anymore, we could still get at the truth of what you're saying by recognizing that the only real security that we have, the only real validation is in God. In other words, it's that spiritual value. As Kennedy said in the quote with which we started, how did he put it about the conscience? With a good conscience as our only sure reward, right? That's a modern, demythologized way of talking about the ultimate, right? The heavenly reward. With a good conscience as our only sure reward.
Big difference between Bonhoeffer and Hitler.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Hitler was himself working out the politics of revenge, right? Of
the politics of a sense of being disappointed and betrayed.
Blame.
Yes, blaming others. And if you've ever heard a videotape of Hitler's rallies in the big football stadiums, you can see that he summoned up almost a prophetic charisma, a kind of religious zealotry, in order to bring violence upon those that he saw as responsible for his disappointment. That's the lesson, that's the profound lesson of our text for today. Luke's Jesus blocks that, right? He says, that's wrong, that's not the way. The Son of Man came to heal the souls of people. Good point. Thank you all so much for this hard
Thank
work
you.
Today. See you next week.
Thank you also.
I will follow you.
Yes, we've got him at the